Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves, presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp for your chance to win a $200 tattered cover gift certificate. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
We really want to welcome you to the Tattered Cover as we welcome Stephen Mitchell with his new book, The Second Book of the Tao. Stephen was educated in Amherst, University of Paris, and Yale. He has many highly regarded translations. I don't know how he has time to do all this, to write these things and edit them and learn these languages. He's translated from German, Hebrew, Greek, Latin, French, Spanish, Italian, and Danish, and I think Chinese and maybe Sanskrit, I think I heard. So the second book of the Tao follows his enormously successful Tao Te Ching, and he's going to read some tonight, and then he's going to answer some of your questions. So we really came to hear him, not me. But anyway, let's welcome him and hear what he has to tell us tonight.
Thank you. I'm glad that you came. About 20 years ago, I spent some wonderful months doing an adaptation of the Tao Te Ching. And I hadn't opened it again for more than a dozen years. Of course, once you live with that book to any depth, and certainly the kind of time that I had spent with it, it runs through your whole body and your blood and your bones, and so you don't need to open it. But in any case, about 5 years ago, I had the idea of reading the book to my wife, Byron Katie. I don't know if any of you know the work of Byron Katie or her books, but I thought that it would be an amazing experience to have the reaction of a person who lives in perfect harmony with the way things are always and can't find a problem, and to get the vivid reaction of somebody like this seemed to me a great benefit to all of us. And so I spent a number of months reading her my version of the Tao Te Ching day by day, line by line, chapter by chapter, and writing down her response and asking her questions and directing her this way and that way toward places that I thought might be helpful to people, places in the text which weren't necessarily that obvious. And once I had gathered quite a large mass of material on my laptop, I began to shape it. And sometimes from 10 pages of material, there might be three sentences or three pages. But it was a very fascinating process of shaping the brilliance of her spoken word into the written word. We sometimes joke with each other that she's the only living author that I've translated into English. But it was a wonderful process. And a wonderful book. It turned out to be an extraordinary book. I think the most profound book on spirituality that exists, because it's not only a commentary on that Tao Te Ching, it's a portrait of the mind completely at ease with itself and with the world, and a way that people can look out into the world through the eyes of somebody who understands the mind thoroughly. At any rate, after this year of immersion in the Tao Te Ching, something started to percolate in me, and I thought, well, maybe it's actually going to happen that I'm going to have a chance to do some dancing with Shuang Tzu. Shuang Tzu is the great disciple of Lao Tzu. I had had this on my mind for more than a dozen years and had never found a form for it. And so one day when I was looking at some older translations of mine from yet another old Chinese dude named Tzu Su, who was Confucius's grandson, it suddenly occurred to me that rather than prose translations, they could be done very beautifully in verse, and that would allow me to be more compressed and more lyrical and more witty. And so I started, and the translations came effortlessly, and they just started piling up. And then I thought, well, maybe I'll try this with Shuang Tzu as well. And those as well came effortlessly. And pretty soon I had 64 chapters. I had wanted to have 81 chapters for this book to be a mirror parallel with the Tao Te Ching, which has 81 chapters. But I couldn't find 81 passages of the highest quality in terms of depth and clarity and wit. And so since 81 is 9 times 9, I thought I'd try 8 times 8, 64. And only later did I realize that there were 64 chapters in the I Ching and 64 squares on the chessboard and 64 basic positions in the Kama Sutra, and that 64 was the only two-digit number ever to star in a Beatles song. And as a footnote, for those of you who are interested, the only single-digit number ever to star in a major Beatles song is the square root of 64. There must be some cosmic significance in that. At any rate, within a couple of months, I had 64 chapters, and I thought that all that remained was to write a foreword and an extensive notes section where I could play some interesting games with the text. And then when I was on the phone one day with my agent, an old friend, Michael Katz, discussing this matter, Michael said, why don't you make it very personal and take it down to the present? And I mulled on his comment, and within a short time, I started to write commentaries for each chapter, and these appear on the right-hand page facing the actual chapter in the book. And these commentaries are elucidations of the text, or exemplifications of the text, or contradictions of it, or all sorts of directions that I felt called to go off in the spirit of Shuang Tzu, for whom nothing is sacred. So I felt that I had, from the start, infinite permission to do whatever I felt like, which is what he did with his teacher, Lao Tzu. So it was a wonderful experience of following the wind wherever it led. I'd like to read you a small number of these chapters, and then I'll open the evening up for questions and answers. This is chapter 2. Before sorrow, anger, longing, or fear have arisen, you are in the center. When these emotions appear, and you know how to see through them, you are in harmony. That center is the root of the universe. That harmony is the Tao, which reaches out to all things. Once you find the center and achieve harmony, heaven and earth take their proper places, and all things are fully nourished. commentary. This chapter is about saving the world. You save the world when you save yourself. There's no one else you can save. Returning to the center is thus an act of infinite kindness. There's nothing wrong with sorrow, anger, longing, or fear. A painful emotion is just a signal that you've left the center. When you are at peace, everything is at peace. What seemed like cacophony becomes the music of the spheres, a suite for unaccompanied mind. Living in harmony with the way things are, the mind finds its center everywhere, its circumference nowhere. The part becomes the whole. What is becomes what should be. Heaven takes its proper, its only place on earth. Most of these chapters, as I said, are in verse in my English, but a dozen or so are in prose. They're the most wonderful, wicked little parables and dialogues that I felt didn't lend themselves to verse. So the kind of prose teeters on the edge of verse and on the edge of nonsense, and that's what is one of the things, anyway, that's so wonderful about it. This is chapter 4. When we exhaust our minds by clinging to a particular side of reality without realizing the underlying oneness, it's called 3 in the morning. What does that mean? A monkey trainer handing out acorns said, "Each of you will get 3 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. The monkeys were outraged. So he said, "All right then, you'll get 4 in the morning and 3 in the afternoon. The monkeys were delighted. Nothing essential had changed, yet one statement produced anger and the other joy. The trainer simply knew how to adapt to reality, and he lost nothing by it. Thus the master uses his skill to harmonize with both sides and rests in the Tao which makes all things equal. This is called walking on 2 paths at once." Commentary. The whole human condition is present in this tricky little tale, which would be sad if it weren't so ridiculous. Although from the standpoint of the monkeys, it's about the power of righteous indignation. From the standpoint of the monkey trainer, behind the scenes, it's about skillful management. You have to admire his 1-2 punch. He's both bad cop and good cop. But what is the trainer training the monkeys in, anyway? Discernment? If so, he's being made a monkey of. Whenever we cling to a particular side of reality, it's we who are the monkeys, losing ourselves in outrage or partial delight. If we look more carefully, though, we can see that reality has only one side, like a Mobius strip. Stars or raindrops, acorns or ashes, apparent blessings, apparent disasters. When the mind is clear, each is an occasion for rejoicing. That's what discernment is about. Once our mind monkeys are fully trained, it's all good. In the mathematics of mental peace, 3 equals 4, 1 equals 0. Adapting to reality means recognizing that nothing underlies or overlays it. The master can travel on 2 paths at once, like a photon, because his mind is free. He's subatomic and supererogatory. He knows that all ways are the way, and that ultimately he is neither coming nor going. This is chapter 9. Xuang Tzu dreamt that he was a butterfly, fluttering here and there, carefree, unaware of a Xuang Tzu. Then he woke up, and there he was again, Xuang Tzu, beyond a doubt. But was he Chuang Tzu who had dreamt that he was a butterfly? Or a butterfly now dreaming that he was Chuang Tzu? There must be some difference between Chuang Tzu and a butterfly. This is called the transformation of things. Commentary. The most famous dream in human history. You may feel that, as with Zeno's paradoxes, there is something specious going on here, if only you could put your finger on it. But the more closely you examine the story, the more penetrating Chuang Tzu's question becomes. He's the anti-serpent in the garden, tempting you to take one little bite from the tree of life. He's Alice's caterpillar, puffing on his hookah and asking, "Who are you?" In fact, with time running backward as in a Feynman diagram, Alice's caterpillar could well have metamorphosed into Chuang Tzu's butterfly, just to prove a point. You may be recalling that psyche, the Greek word for soul, can also mean butterfly. But let's leave the Greeks out of this. Chuang Tzu is definitely Chinese, he thinks. His butterfly is not a metamorphosis, not a metaphor. It's just a butterfly. Just? How can we know what depths of joy lie hidden within that pinpoint of a brain? The whole world contained in a garden, in a single flower. All time contained in a summer's day, and life one all-embracing, multi-orgasmic fragrance. And who knows what a butterfly might dream of? Of an ancient Chinese philosopher, perhaps, or of a 19th-century Oxford don who was enchanted by little girls. This particular butterfly woke up as Chuang Tzu. Or was it Chuang Tzu who woke up as himself? There he was again, beyond a doubt. Beyond a doubt? Ha! Things change before our very eyes, whether our eyes are open or shut. A butterfly becomes a man. A man becomes a question mark. A question mark becomes a winged creature, carefree, doing whatever it likes. Thus, identity melts away, and we are left with something more valuable. A self, a non-self, that includes it all. This is chapter 14, one of my favorite chapters. Actually, whenever I read a chapter, it's my favorite chapter, so let's strike that last comment. 14. Prince Wenhui's cook, Ding, was cutting up an ox. Every touch of his hand, every ripple of his shoulders, every step of his feet, every thrust of his knees, every cut of his knife was in perfect harmony, like the dance of the mulberry grove, like the chords of the lynx head music. "Well done," said the prince. "How did you gain such skill?" Putting down his knife, Ding said, "I follow the Tao, Your Highness, which goes beyond all skills. When I first began cutting up oxen, all I could see was the ox. After 3 years, I had learned to look beyond the ox. Nowadays, I see with my whole being, not with my eyes. I sense the natural lines, and my knife slides through by itself, never touching a joint, much less a bone." A good cook changes knives once a year. He cuts. An ordinary cook changes knives once a month. He hacks. "This knife of mine has lasted for 19 years. It has cut up thousands of oxen, but its blade is as sharp as if it were new. Between the joints there are spaces, and the blade has no thickness. Having no thickness, it slips right through. There's more than enough room for it. And when I come to a difficult part, I slow down, I focus my attention, I barely move, the knife finds its way until suddenly the flesh falls apart on its own. I stand there and let the joy of the work fill me. Then I wiped the blade clean and put it away. "Bravo!" cried the prince. "From the words of this cook, I have learned how to live my life." Commentary. In his Rules for Right Livelihood, the Buddha proscribed trafficking in meat, and in weapons, slaves, intoxicants, and poison. Clearly, he never imagined someone like Prince Wenhui's cook, an artist of ox flesh, a saint of the bloody carcass. So much for rules. This just shows that nothing in life can be categorized or excluded. The whole world is our palate. Ding, it must be said, was a man of supreme integrity, who trusted what is and needed no one's appreciation. For decades, he had been putting on his one-man show for an audience of zero. No one was watching, not even he. The glorious harmony of motion and intention simply happened without him. How can we know the dancer from the dance? In the practice of butchery, he had learned how to step aside and let his body do the thinking. He followed the Tao into a world of unadulterated sensation, an Eden of the don't-know mind. The vast universe with its myriad kiliocosms within kiliocosms became a single knife blade gliding through empty space. What did it matter that his material was slaughtered oxen rather than sounds or colors or words? Nothing remained but the pure joy of the work. And let's not forget the admirable Wen Hui. Instead of being caught up in princely pursuits like governing, hunting, or dallying with his concubines, there he was in the kitchen, taking exquisite notice of the lowly, which turned out to contain the supreme. When the student is ready, the teacher appears. This is chapter 15. I remember when I was quite a young person and first encountering Shuang Tzu in the vast quantity of material, much of which is pretty dull and pretty silly. I remember reading this passage and falling in love. This is chapter 15. The ancient masters slept without dreaming and woke up without concerns. Their food was spare and simple. Their breath went deep. They didn't hold on to life, and they faced death free of concepts, emerging without desire, going back without resistance. They never forgot their beginning. They didn't trouble their minds searching for what their end was. They received life as a gift and handed it back gratefully. Minds supple, faces serene, in a crisis cool as autumn, in relationships warm as spring. They were balanced throughout the four seasons and in harmony with the Tao. There was no limit to their freedom. And that last line I've found is as true as it is beautiful. Commentary. The ancient masters had pared themselves down to the essential. They woke up, they ate, they worked, they made love, they raised their families, all the while unseduced by any thoughts that arose. This gave their lives a sense of spaciousness. They always had enough time to do what wanted to be done. They moved through each day as alert and unhurried as animals in the wild. How could they forget their beginning? That's where they were constantly centered, in the moment before a thought. They had returned to the primordial, mind hovering over its own abyss, objectless, serene. No wonder their nights were dreamless and their skies full of stars. Gratitude makes no distinctions. It precedes its occasion. It is the magic well that never runs dry, the still waters where you kneel and see your own face, more beautiful than you could have imagined. This is chapter 23. Master Su, Master Yu, Master Li, and Master Lai were talking. Whoever can see non-being as his head, life as his back, and death as his butt, whoever knows that existence and non-existence are one body, that's someone we can be friends with. The four men looked at one another and smiled. Then Master Yu got sick. Master Su went to visit him. "How are you?" he said. Master Yu said, "Amazing. Look at how the Creator has bent me out of shape. My back is so curved that my intestines are on top of me. My chin digs into my belly button, my shoulders arch over my head, and my neck bones point to the sky." Yet he seemed peaceful and unconcerned. Hobbling over to the well, he looked in and said, "My, my, how totally he has bent me out of shape." "Are you discouraged?" asked Master Su. "Not at all," Master Yu said. "Why should I be? If things go on like this, maybe he'll change my left arm into a rooster and I'll announce the dawn. Maybe he'll change my right arm into a crossbow and I'll shoot a duck for dinner. Or maybe he'll change my buttocks into wheels, and with my spirit for a horse, I'll climb up into myself and go for a ride. I won't ever need a wagon again. I received life when the time came, and I'll give it back when the time comes. Anyone who understands the proper order of things, that everything happens at exactly the right time, will be untouched by sorrow or joy. In ancient times, this was called original freedom. When you argue with reality, you lose. It has always been this way. That's why I have no complaint whatsoever." Those of you who know the work or the words of my wife, Byron Katie, will recognize little sentences here and there that keep cropping up and that I've shamelessly plagiarized, although I have noted them in the notes section here. They were just too good not to be used. Commentary. These four old Chinese sages who have met in the intimacy of realization are like the men whom Yeats saw carved in lapis lazuli, climbing toward a little halfway house sweetened by plum or cherry branch. Where are Shuangtzu's men? In a garden? In a tea shop? The setting doesn't matter. Wherever it is, whether flowers surround them or falling leaves, I delight to imagine them seated there, knowing themselves to the core, saying only what is essential, and smiling in appreciation of the emptiness at the heart of things. End of Act 1. Act 2 is the answer to Job. Perhaps 20 years have gone by, or 20 days. Master Yu is afflicted with a neuromuscular syndrome that has bent him over like a paperclip. Afflicted? No. Presented. Graced. He relates his symptoms with the aplomb of a pathologist teaching a case study, a connoisseur describing a masterpiece. No wonder he's so kind to himself. He had no preconceptions. He doesn't take the disease personally. People think that detachment must be a cold, humorless business. But Master Yu couldn't be more witty or engaging. Will his left arm turn into a rooster, his right arm a crossbow, his buttocks the wheels of a chariot? Anything can happen, after all, in this world of perpetual transformation, and he trusts that it will all be turned to good use. His amused segue into the surreal is a portrait of the mind at ease with itself. To conclude the dialogue, we're given a statement of what the masters are masters of. It's as if the smiles of the four old men have been transubstantiated into words. Original freedom, the epitome of imperturbability, the gaiety of the mind that cannot be upset by anything that happens, because at last it has met itself with understanding. Two more. This is chapter 36. Whatever happens or doesn't happen, can you center yourself in the Tao? Can you stop looking to others and focus on your innermost self? Can you return to the beginning of the world and be like a newborn baby? It can scream its head off all day, yet it never becomes hoarse. It can clench its fist for hours, yet its fingers never get cramped. It can stare all day without blinking, yet its eyes never grow tired. Free from concerns and worries, unaware of itself, it moves without thinking, doesn't know why things happen, doesn't need to know. To act without needing a reason, to sit still without knowing how, to ride the current of what is, this is the primal virtue. Commentary. People think that entering the kingdom of heaven has something to do with good and evil. But as Jesus implied, every mother's child wakes up in the kingdom of heaven. Heaven is intimacy, the world before separation. It looks exactly like earth, but without the thoughts that branch out in 1,000 directions too heavy for us to bear. Our first parents were not the good children in a morality tale. They were enchanted with each other and with themselves. Adam staring into the mirror of phenomena, Eve singing as she plaited a wreath. The tree they ate from was not called the tree of evil. It was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. They became mere grown-ups the moment they bit into that bitter fruit. They opened their eyes and thought that they knew something. They heard the voice of guilt and punishment walking in the garden in the cool of the day. They imagined that they were naked, when all the while they were clad in all earthly abundance and crowned with the moon and stars. And to conclude, this is chapter 53. As he was eating by the side of the road, Lietzu saw an old skull. He pulled it out of the weeds, contemplated it, and said, "Only you and I know that there is no such thing as death and no such thing as life." Commentary. The philosopher Lietzu has stopped for lunch on his journey from here to there. He sits down by the side of the road, opens his knapsack, takes out a few rice balls and a piece of dried fish. It's a leisurely meal. He has nowhere in particular to go. Suddenly, he notices an old skull. He pulls it out of the weeds for a tete-a-tete. He has no ideas about whoever used to inhabit it, no pity, no urge to do an alas poor Yorick. The skull is his colleague. It may look a bit hollow, but it knows exactly what he knows. "You too," Lietzu says, "have no mind to contend with. You don't tell yourself lies about pain multiplied beyond one body. You realize that death is a noun without a plural. Only one person ever dies. If that," says the skull, "a master of understatement." So that gives you a flavor. Well, it's time to conclude. I'd be very glad to sign books if any of you want me to sign.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we've been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp for your chance to win a $200 Tattered Cover gift certificate and learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.